Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I said the same thing last week. It's a tired old joke now, but I'm very glad you applaud me before I start, because you may not feel the same at the end. Welcome, everybody. Delighted y'all came, and look forward to our time together for the next hour, and hope you'll return for subsequent sessions as well. The beauty of this is they're all standalone sessions, so if you need to get out and hike early one morning or something like that, you're not going to miss anything. There's no, last week it was continuity, this week it's individual stories. And the beauty of this is I need very, very little preparation, because we're going to approach some of these stories as a group and in small groups. If you're an introvert, we'll make space for you to work on your own, or you can just remain silent in a small group. We're not making demands on anybody. I'm calling this Sunday School Stories Now We're All Grown Up. I guess some clarification on terms would be useful. When we talk about Sunday school back in Ireland, we're talking about children. I know some parishes and congregations would have adult Sunday school. But this is, I want you to all remember back to when you were children. A long way looking back. that's a fair comment, because we were having a conversation about this just a moment ago. But remember back to when you were a child in Sunday school and the kind of stories you were told. And how those stories were told to you, and how you lived with those stories. They've been with you, they've been part of the fabric of your life, they've got into your bones and under your skin over the course of your life. And this is an opportunity this week to explore those stories, to see how and if they have changed over that period of time, to see what we're familiar with and what we may have forgotten or maybe never even knew that are part of the stories. I'm passionate about stories and about storytelling. Who are we, any of us as individuals, without our stories? We make meaning of our lives through the stories we tell of our lives and of one another. So, and I love the fact that so much of the Bible is story and narrative. This is not for the tape. This is not for the recording. But if I never have to read Paul again for the rest of my life, I would not be unhappy. If I never heard a sermon from a letter of Paul or Peter or John or any of them, I would not cry a single tear. But if I lost the parables, or if I lost the narrative of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, that would grieve me deeply. Because in large parts, that's how I learned to live. A number of months ago, in our own congregation, I attend a Presbyterian church back home. And over the course of this week, I'll tell you a little bit about my own story, just because it's in the nature of this. But I attend a Presbyterian congregation. Been there for best part of 30 years, still can't call myself a Presbyterian, so I attend a Presbyterian church. And we had a visiting preacher with us one weekend, early part of this year, February time. And I didn't go, I was working, but I was handling the recordings from the events, and one of them was a big file, big sound file, and I was looking for a place to cut it and set it up into a couple of small ones. So I had to listen to part of what was being said, and the preacher had everybody round tables involved in little groups, and he said, and he'd handed out everybody little pieces of Bible text, and he said, I want you to ask these two questions, or these three questions, about the Bible text on your table. And he gave them the three questions. And then he said, so I'm going to give you 20 minutes to talk about this in your small groups, and then I want somebody from the table to feed back into the bigger group. It's, you know, it's standard practice. And obviously, somebody at one of the tables, their face kind of registered panic, and the preacher said, "Oh no, don't worry about the feedback. I'm just interested in what you gleaned through the questions, and don't worry about the feedback because I have all the answers here." And I thought, I'm kind of glad I didn't go to those sessions. These sessions together are not sessions in which you're going to walk away with the answer to a story. There's no such thing as an answer to a story. And there's no such thing as the meaning of a story. And so we're going to resist that. We're going to look at different stories throughout the text, and we're going to explore them together. We're going to use a variety of techniques to rewrite some aspects of it, maybe to introduce voices that maybe should have been there but aren't. We're going to, particularly with the parables, we're going to, almost every parable Jesus says he never finishes. Really frustrating storyteller. So what happened next? He just leaves it. And we're going to write the endings. We're going to look at some stories from characters in the story that we wouldn't normally think about, or wouldn't even pay attention to, perhaps. And try to find our way, try to find a doorway in the story that will open a new room for us, in which to make sense of our lives and our faith and our place in this world. And you know the beauty of it is, you see, when we were children and we were hearing some of these stories as children, there was a doorway that was opened for us by our teachers and our leaders. And as children, we stepped through into a new room of understanding. Thing is, that room then had other doors as we grew older. And we have the opportunity of opening those doors as we've grown up in faith. But sometimes the door that is opened for us in these stories as children is into another room, is the room we stay in all our lives. And because the meaning of the story was presented to us, and we think it's then locked down into something and it can't change. Meanwhile, life, I don't even know if this is a word, but life complexifies, gets more complicated. Lots of things happen to us, and the road we're on takes all sorts of twists and turns. But still we're stuck in this room with the Bible text story and the meaning we got as 7 or 8 year olds. And our paths have diverged. And it is so easy, and I'm sure we all know it at times in our lives, or we see it in other people that we know, that divergence, as people have grown older, has often meant a growing away from the Bible text. And we become a little bit embarrassed by the text, a little bit, maybe even a little bit ashamed of what we used to believe as children. And we leave that room behind and we try to beat down the wall to open out into something else. I am absolutely passionate about the fact that we can carry this text with us. But it means we need to resist the temptation to look for the meaning of the text. And so they're the ground rules for this week. One other thing I need to say, sometimes at some stage this week, and nobody, I'm going to tell you in now, but somebody new will come along at some stage this week and say, does that mean that everything I used to believe about that story is now untrue? Of course it doesn't. That was one room you entered in, and it made sense at that time, but there are other rooms off this one. There are other ways of reading this story, and there are other layers. It's the brilliance of storytelling. Again, I don't know what it's like here back home, particularly in the Protestant and Reformed churches that I'm part of. We resist these layers of meaning in favor of a tight, close, forensic analysis of a story. Anyway, so we'll all bring something to this, and we'll all bring our own experience of these stories. If you're a preacher in the room, try and resist giving us all your last sermon. Not that it wasn't a good one, just that this is an opportunity to explore stories and how stories work in our lives. It's and if you feel that I'm sermonizing from the front, just signal to me and I'll shut up as well. But that's these are we've just got 5 stories this week, and I hope that they will somehow resonate with you. And if there's a need there, maybe reignite your passion for the Bible and the Bible text and the stories of the Bible. Does that sound like a reasonable way forward? That's good, because I've nothing else ready. So there are lots of ways of reading the Bible text. There are, if you need a Bible text, there are Bibles on the shelves back here. Feel free to get up. I'm going to throw the text up on the screen. That's the only slides for this morning, will be the text. And if you don't trust that I haven't doctored the text that's up, you can grab one of these behind and follow along. But if you have a Bible with you, close it. Don't, or on your phone, turn it off. Because there are lots of different ways of reading the Bible text. One is we can open it on the page, and we talked about this last week, reading a story. Sometimes when we're sitting with the Bible and we open it, and it's a big, profound book, often with big leather covers and lots of tight print on its flimsy pages, and our whole body posture changes because it's the Bible. let's approach these as stories, and let's see where these lead us. One way of reading this text is to recreate it from our memories. So let's try and recreate the story that we popularly know as the Good Samaritan from memories. This is where you come in. give me some detail about the story. I'm just looking sentences or words or characters or context. Again, I don't want you to tell me the whole thing. Let's try and recreate it together from our corporate memory. So, how does the story open?
A lawyer was testing Jesus.
Someone was testing Jesus. What was the nature of the test? So, Nita, as Sharon said, playground voices. What was the nature of the text? Or the nature of the challenge?
How do I inherit eternal life?
Yep, good. Who is my neighbor? Is a central question. Is the question that the guy asks Jesus. We'll look at that in just a moment. Yep, who is my neighbor? We're going to hopefully make that phrase live now in the context, in your context here nationally and internationally. And I've got my own opinions of what that means in our Brexit context back home, but good. So that's the context. So tell me the story. What happens in the story?
A man is traveling down the road.
Yeah, and we're given the origin and destination.
Jerusalem and Jericho.
Okay.
A wilderness road.
A wilderness road. A dangerous road. Yep. Yeah. And?
And it falls into the hands of robbers.
Falls into the hands of robbers. Who?
Just before we get to the robbers, it's like a guy goes...
Do you know what? You know what he tells me before the start? I've written a book on the parables.
Oh, come on.
Just like... So I need to get my hands on that. But No, but yes, go ahead.
I think it's like a guy goes into a bar. You know, Jesus says, surely you recognize this kind of situation.
Exactly.
Like a guy goes into a bar, and everybody can't wait to hear what happened to this guy when he goes into a bar. That's kind of how I see this.
Exactly.
Guy's walking down.
Before we have all this theological weight around these things, this is Jesus just telling a story. And we're going to come back later to why he tells a story here, because it's, for me... as an Irishman, where story is such a central part of our culture, I find it fascinating. Particularly, I was trained in theology in a Reformed college. So, with all apologies to the systematic theologians in the room, I'm not one of them, for good reason, which will become clear. But yes, so it's an ordinary story. Man going down a road, falls into the hands of thieves and...
Beaten and left for dead.
Gets beaten and is left for dead. Good. Next. What happens next?
Priest walks by.
A priest walks by and...
On the other side of the street.
He crosses the road and passes down on the other side. Next.
A Levite walks by.
A Levite walks by. You can get an A star. And good. And he does exactly the same. Then there's the big kind of reveal in the story. What happens next? This is really interesting. This story is so familiar, nobody wants to admit to the fact that we know what happens next. but this is why sometimes our familiarity with the story creates a barrier to us, because we can even skip over our reading of it. We can skim read it because we know exactly what comes next. So what does come next?
A Samaritan comes
near, and preach this one to me. I'll give you permission for a couple of minutes to open this one up.
And gives him aid. He helps him. He dresses his wounds. He puts the man on his donkey and takes him to an inn.
Great. Grace. Yeah. Yes, Justine?
I don't know it very well. I remember the skeleton of the story, but Samaritan, I believe, has come to mean good Samaritan in our culture, and the fact that there's an adjective, Samaritans were jerks, yep, that we didn't like, right?
Yep, absolutely. We're getting it. We're veering into interpretation now when we're looking for story, but we will. Need to address that. Samaritans do have a poor reputation. You might get a chance to look at that in a moment. So he dresses his wounds, puts him on his donkey, brings him to an inn, and then what happens?
Pays for his upkeep and care.
Yeah. Does anybody know how much he paid?
Just laid down his credit card.
It's actually a little bit more specific than that, and it becomes a really important part of the story. Does anybody remember how much he pays?
Two
silver coins. Really, really important. And then says...
If you need more.
Speak it up.
If you need more, I'll catch it next time I go through.
Yeah, yeah. Story over. And then what does Jesus say?
Who
was a neighbor? And the man says,
the one who showed him mercy.
Right. Okay, hold all that in your head. We're now just going to read the story as it is in the Bible text. What I want you to do is look out for if there's any detail that we missed. I don't think there's a great deal of detail, but now that we've recreated the story together, there will be undoubtedly one or two things that we left out. So keep an eye out for little details that we didn't recreate, or details that you forgot were there or didn't even know were there. And because this kind of a reading that we've just done alerts us to the pieces of the story we're really, really familiar with, but it also highlights the pieces of the story that we've forgotten or the pieces of the story that we never knew. And oftentimes when it comes to a rereading of those stories as adults, it's those details we need to focus on. They're our route in, they're the door, potentially a door into a new room. And so keep an eye out as we go through. Yes, sir?
Yeah, and I guess just the foundation of why that question was asked.
Yeah.
Being how to love your neighbor.
Yeah. And we will, and again, we will come to some kind of way of getting underneath the detail, but we're trying to recreate the story now for the time being. Because I've got the mic, let me read. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law, he replied. How do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. You've answered correctly, Jesus replied. Do this and you'll live. But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? In reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, 2 silver pieces, gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus told him, go and do likewise. This is an absolutely brilliant, brilliant example of Jesus' storytelling. Anything on that page that we neglected or anything we'd forgotten or anything that surprised you as we read the Bible text together? Yes?
The word stripped.
Stripped, yeah. I mean, this is a laying bare of this man. This is a violent attack. Be interesting to take that and see how does Jesus strip bare this expert in the law through his storytelling? Yep, anything else on that page what do you think this man is trying to do? Well, first off, actually, let me ask you a prior question. What's your feelings towards this expert in the law? Do you have... And again, there's no right answer here. I'm not looking for a right answer. I'm looking for your response. What are your feelings towards this man in the story?
Sometimes I feel sympathetic towards him because I know that there are things that I want to justify myself away from. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what he's trying to do with this question. When he asks, who is my neighbor, he's trying to have Jesus say something that's a little bit easier than what he ends up saying.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I know sometimes I want the easier answer in my life.
Yeah. So your feeling is you can see a degree of sympathy for him in the question, that this is a genuine search for some wisdom. Does anybody have an opposite reaction to that?
I think he was trying to trip Jesus up.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and certainly Luke thinks he's trying to test Jesus. I veer back and forth. I do, at times, I can see this man. I have sympathy for this man. I think there's a genuine sense of search here. But Luke certainly alerts us to the fact that there was something beneath what he was doing. Yeah, Chuck?
Yeah, I kind of see the person asking the question is very pragmatic.
Yeah.
He needs to get from A to B to C, and Jesus is trying to take him into a creative path. That
open up
doorways.
Yeah. Look at what's going on here. On this occasion, the teacher of the law stood up to test Jesus, and he asks a question. What must I do to inherit eternal life? Well, Jesus says, look, read your Bible. And what's written in the law? How do you read the law? Which should alert us to the fact that certainly where Jesus was concerned, there was a variety of ways of reading the text. There was no single track along which you travel. You could. And he offers this, I think, how many words? There's about 30 words there. So he takes the Torah, he takes the books of the law, the first 5 books of the Bible, and he shrinks them down into just 31 words or 30-something words from memory. Someone can count them there. But he's shrunk the whole of the law of Moses down into this
very, very impressive definition. All of the law. And you wouldn't think that to read the law. You know, if you get stuck in the middle of Leviticus, yeah. It's really, really hard to imagine that love is the focus of the law. But actually, that feels true, and certainly from the work we did last week in the Book of Ruth, and the way the Book of Ruth is used liturgically in Jewish tradition, there is a suggestion that loving kindness and compassion, that the law of Moses was given to increase the store of love and compassion in the world. And this guy has got it. He's got it. So he's got this summary, and this summary appears to be, I think he's got to the core of something. You've answered correctly. Jesus agrees. The purpose of the law is love. Love God, love neighbor. That's the whole of the law. So do this and you'll live. So what Jesus is doing is saying, yes, intellectually you've got this right, but it's not about correct knowledge or correct belief, it's about action in the world. So, yeah, I'm really impressed you've been able to summarize the law in this way, but actually you need to get out and do it. Wanting to justify himself, he asks, so, Jesus, can we have a conversation about this? Can we find an even better definition? Can we narrow this law thing? Can we narrow this faith life thing? Can we take the law of Moses to 30-something words? Can we take it down even smaller? This is why I'm not a systematic theologian, because of what Jesus does next. When the man says, define it tighter, define it tighter, define it tighter, give me a simple rule that I can do, Jesus resists that entirely. And what does Jesus do? Jesus tells a story. This is really, I find this fascinating, that faced with the need to define faith ever closer and ever tightly, to draw ever clearer lines around who's in and who's out, Jesus tells a story which explodes the definitions wide open. And because it's not possible with a good story, there is no single point to the good story. A good story, it's like water running downhill. It'll find all sorts of channels to make its way. So resisting the need to define, the story explodes it. And in particular, the story explodes it by putting law, neat, tidy, clean, systematized law, into an emergency situation. So Jesus' story pushes life to the right out to the extreme margins of normal life and says, so tell me, how does your definition work when this happens? Because law works really neatly when life is running in that straight line, because by and large you just keep her between the hedges and you don't have to worry about the law. Nobody thinks about the law when things are going straight. It's only when you veer off the road or life takes these unexpected turns that law begins to break down. Justine, yeah?
I'm wondering about our use of the word law. It's on the top of the first page, and then it's capitalized somewhere, and you yourself translated it loosely as Bible at one point, but we were picturing sort of, Chuck used the word pragmatic. You know, we're picturing lawyer jokes in our head. So
this is not the statute books that we know, that, you know, the Supreme Court and all the rest of it. This is the law of Moses. This is the rules Moses handed down in those first five books. What you could do, what you couldn't do, like the Ten Commandments, like how to observe Sabbath, like what to do with your farming techniques, like in the law. What happens when, you know, your donkey falls into a pit on the Sabbath, what do you do? So push, and then it gets, when you push to the margins of life, things get really
really difficult. So Jesus tells a story to say, like, this is not about keeping rules. Faith can never be about keeping the rules. Because there will always be situations at which you have to make a choice in a situation. And then he tells this story. So rather than giving you a definition, let me tell you a story. What would you do in the context of this? This man was going down, he was beaten up, and he was lying half dead at the side of the road, naked and bleeding. The law of Moses is really, really clear about what to do in this situation. You do not touch the dead body or the half dead body. You do not touch the blood. You do not, because that would make you unclean, ritually unclean. So when the priest and the Levite pass by, everybody listened to Jesus telling the story goes, I'd like to have him as my priest. He knows how to keep the law. Everybody listening to Jesus tell this story believes that the priest and the Levite do the right thing. This is what you are supposed to do. The Samaritan, on the other hand, well, he's a Samaritan, as you pointed out. And there's a lot of history. Mainly it's to do, and this is where it's this story, in it, there's one way in which the story begins to come home. Once upon a time, in that part of the world, there was a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. They split. They had a big. It used to be all Israel, and then they had a war between rival factions, and the country split in two. And once upon a time, this big army with empire ambitions swept in to the northern kingdom on its way south towards Egypt, and obliterated the northern kingdom, but stopped here. Egyptians came up and all sorts of things happened, but it stopped here. But the result was the northern kingdom was destroyed and never reappeared again. It happened later to the southern kingdom, but it happened in a different way. The way this empire had of settling kingdoms that they conquered was that they would bring people in from other parts of the world. You know, other parts of the world they had conquered, they would bring them in and they would mix up the populations so that nobody knew exactly, nobody was clean anymore about where they came from. And this became known, in Jesus' time, this was Samaria. So these were kind of Jews, but not Jews. They were a little bit mixed blood, not pure, you know, not one of us, they were different. And you couldn't trust them. Now, the Samaritans told other stories about these people, as is the way. But these people, which is where Jesus is telling the story, they didn't trust these people because they weren't pure. So they have expectations in their stereotypes of how a Samaritan would act when he sees one of us. And he comes down and he does exactly what the other two, but then everybody says, well, we expect that of them. You know, they're not interested in keeping the law. They're not interested in keeping the rules and staying clean before God. But then, of course, just somewhere in the back of your mind, you begin to think, but what if it was my mother or father or brother or me lying at the side of the road? Well, yeah, I know that the priest and the Levite kept the rules, but what if it was me lying in that situation, looking for somebody to help? I went out a long hike yesterday. Several times, if you saw my legs are cut and scraped, several times near scrapes and real scrapes, thinking, yeah, I could fall off the trail here and, you know, I'm hoping I meet somebody or people who see me on this trail who could report that, yes, we saw him there. I'd like to have somebody, even a Samaritan, maybe. So already Jesus is beginning to mess about with our heads and the law. if it was me, I'd like somebody to help me, even if it was a Samaritan. So he, at significant cost, puts him on his own donkey, takes him to the inn, and takes care of him. The next day, he took out, let's spend a couple of moments on this verse. The next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. Let's do a close reading of that verse. What have we learned? This is the heart of the story. What have we learned from that one verse? Just pieces of information.
He stayed with him.
He stayed with him at considerable risk, because presumably this was a Jewish town, and this guy brings an injured Jewish man into a Jewish town, and he's a Samaritan. He stayed with him. That's a risk. Brilliant. He stayed with him. What else do we, what are the pieces of information?
He's so well off, he's got a donkey.
He's got a donkey and?
Money.
He's got money. The Samaritan seems to be, and he has oil and wine and bandages. He's a resourceful man. Yeah, good. He stays with me, resourceful man.
His commitment is open-ended.
Oh, right now. Unpack that one for me.
It isn't like, here's the cost for what's already happened and I'm gone. I'll be back, and if there's additional cost, he leaves it open.
This is really interesting. Look at this. He took out the 2 coins. It seems to be that these 2 coins are to look after him for the next while. So he's paid whatever it was for the night they've been there. He's also paid him in advance. And
he's planning for the future.
Come through. You're okay. And what is the future? What's in the future of the story?
I'm going to return.
And I'm going to return. Why is he going to return? It's all in this careful reading of the story here. He's going to return. It's this phrase here. Extra expense. Which means these 2 coins for his future care are not going to be enough to get him well.
A down payment.
It's a down payment. So there is going to be extra expense.
Try this in an emergency room.
Now we see our health system is very different. Okay, now I'm going to give you a little bit of work to do for 5 minutes with people beside you. Simple question. What happens next? Because that's the end of the story. What do you want to know? See, there's no more. What do you want to know about what happened next? What choices are open in the story? So just take a minute or two with somebody around you. And as I said, if you don't want to speak, you don't want to talk, just gently let your partner or your neighbor know. And take a minute. What options are open? What would you like to see happen? How would you finish the story? So take a minute, and then we'll come back together.
I'm Dave. I'm Jonathan.
I'm Eva.
Oh, I see that. This is multifaceted.
Yeah. see. I think you need that.
Yeah. That kind of love doesn't turn off. And it probably costs a little bit.
I jumped ahead in the story and I would say no. God is terrible. And he's made a promise to us. He has taken care of us now.
30 seconds.
In the future, he's coming back.
Okay. What options are open in the story? How would you like to see it ended? Why on earth didn't Jesus tell us what happened next? So anybody want to jump? Anybody who hasn't spoken as yet, you want to throw in something for consideration? Yes.
I'd like to know what happens to the injured man and what his story is. What does he say about what happens?
Excellent.
And what happens to him?
Brilliant. I mean, how would the injured man... I guess it all depends on what the innkeeper does at this stage. Mm-hmm. As to what his story might be. Good. And that's one way of taking this, is taking it from the perspective of the injured man and reimagining the story to see what roots, what wisdom that might open for us. Yes, sir?
I hope you don't throw me out of here.
I'll never.
I don't know whether this is true or not, but I believe it is.
I think what you said.
We had a pastor that was a really learned man about scriptures, and he said that this is the most favorite parable of all time. And then Jewish history, it was a priest, a Levite, and a Pharisee. And when Jesus said this, they had to explode.
Yeah.
Right? It just changes the color of everything.
Yeah. Jesus changes a traditional story by introducing like a foreigner, which messes up the way they'd understood, messed up the what it was to keep the law and had to be a good Jew. Yeah. So I'm still interested, how would you end it? Any other new voices in the room that want to? Yeah.
I also wonder how the innkeeper reacted to the Samaritan, you know, providing for this injured man, and if it changed his whole viewpoint of Samaritans and
brilliant.
Hopefully it did.
Brilliant. Here's a question. Mm-hmm. Here's a question. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? Who are the three?
Priest, Levite,
many characters are in the story. There's four characters in the story who react to this man. The priest, the Levite, the Samaritan, and the innkeeper. We know what the priest did, we know what the Levite did, we know what the Samaritan did. We have no idea what the innkeeper did.
That's what we were wondering, is whether the innkeeper followed through.
So, that's the question of the parable.
Yeah.
What did the innkeeper do? What options are open to the innkeeper?
I think if I was a Jew listening to the story, I'd be struck by the Samaritan's trust of the innkeeper as an open blank check. If you were a business person, you might think of all kinds of expenses that they could incur. There's no contract.
Here's a little bit of background information. In some towns in Jesus' day, innkeepers were crooks.
Yeah.
Made bad reputations. And so, just like the expectations of the people are confirmed in relation to the priest and the Levite, they kept the rules. Exploded a little bit by the Samaritan. He gave him money to look after a man in advance. He gave him money in advance and then he left.
Okay.
Everybody in the town knows what he's going to do. So option one for the innkeeper is?
Take the money,
throw the man out.
Sorry, the guy didn't make it.
Sorry, and if the Samaritan ever comes back into foreign territory. I just tell him he died. He's not one of us. This guy is a foreigner in this town. This guy is a stranger to us. We don't know who he is. He's stripped, so we've no identification. We don't know where he came from. I'll just tell him he died. And I'll tell him it cost me 100 silver pieces. If he's got the money he claims he has, he'd pay me and I'll make money. And everybody in the town says, yeah, typical. What other options? So the first thing is that he confirms the stereotype. He confirms the stereotype that people have of innkeepers. We're sticking with the innkeeper now.
Yeah.
So
I'm assuming that the inn and the innkeeper were the best they had as far as a hospital back then. And the innkeeper's open to earning money. And so we may see this as what he does. And he's more interested in earning money than in drawing all the lines of him.
But let's, you see, there's a challenge here. There's a difficult, you see, this is a challenge, extra expense. He's a businessman. What is incurred in this? What does he have to take account of when he thinks, I'm going to have to spend money here? Like, he's a Samaritan.
Yeah.
We all know what they're like. Would I trust him? Will he return? This is going to cost me money. So the option one is, he confirms the stereotype. Everybody, he's a rogue. He pitches the man out, tells the Samaritan he died after 6 weeks or however long it is it takes him to return. What other options are open to the innkeeper?
He actually follows through. He actually takes care of him.
And
he has to trust.
Yeah, I think there is absolutely an option for him to care. But I think there's at least two possibilities. One is, remember we're talking about questions of the law here. One possibility is, let's imagine this will buy 2 weeks of care in the inn. This man is injured seriously enough that two silver coins isn't going to be enough to look after him. It is one option open to the innkeeper is, I know what you all think about me and what I act like, but I'm just to spite the lot of you. I'm going to look after this man. I'm going to fulfill the law. I'm going to spend the 2 denarii. But you see, if he's not well by the last night of the second week, he goes, because all I've been paid for is that, and nobody could say a word against me. I fulfill the law. I do what I'm expected to do, but no more. I'm a legalist. Do what I'm expected, no more. Nobody in this town could ever criticize me or accuse me of being a rogue because I spent the money I was given in the care of this man. No sensible businessman would get into that. So the morning after the money runs out, I will then throw the man out and he can limp out the town for all I care. But at least nobody in the town can criticize me. And the third?
Looking ahead from this and interpreting the story further, if you look at God as...
Not going to interpret the story just yet. I'm trying to come into that.
Okay.
Read the story.
The reaction is he keeps putting out his own resources and trusts that will come in.
Yeah.
Until the guy gets well.
Obviously, I mean, it's really hard not to hear a phrase like that, read a phrase like that, and not think, you know, theologians, we call it eschatologically beyond our time. They're the three options, it seems to me. There may be more.
Glenn, can I add one to the
Certainly.
Third part? And the thing that I'm noticing here this time is the guy's naked. So the innkeeper doesn't know if he's a wealthy man or not, because if this guy, if he knew this guy had a lot of money that was lying on the side of the road, that might not require as much trust. You know what I mean?
I'm not let him go.
Yeah,
until he pays me.
Exactly.
And make him pay.
But he has no idea what this guy's worth.
This is where the stripped thing is really important. There's no identifying features. So three options. One, confirm the stereotype, the rogue that everybody knows he is. Two, the legalist. I'll do exactly what I'm required to do and no more. Or three, he might be so inspired by the example of the Samaritan that he might. It's a huge, and now it is a big, big step, trusting a Samaritan to come back, trusting that the Samaritan has the resources, trusting that he will trust me to tell when I say how much it costs. There is just the possibility that the example of the Samaritan could be transformative of the innkeeper. And of course, we are then encouraged to think, what would I do? What would I do with that story? So when Jesus says, and here we'll wrap this up now in a moment, which of these three? The only character in the story who is asked to go beyond and out of his own resources is the innkeeper. He's the only person whose story is unfinished in this. The Samaritan has acted compassionately, but the Samaritan acts compassionately out of resources he obviously has. The innkeeper doesn't. The innkeeper has a bad reputation. But there is the possibility that a previously bad reputation could be redeemed, to use that word, could be changed, transformed. To do so requires that he acts out of a promise, the trust in a promise, that this Samaritan will come again and will repay. Now, time's against us. So, I think we are not required by the story to think that it's priest, Levite, and Samaritan. As I said earlier, there are four characters. To me, where I am in my life, I guess, today, the most fascinating character with the most possibility for narrative development is the innkeeper. And it could be that because nobody says, could be that the innkeeper is the third character, because the Samaritan acts out of his own resources. So, let's look at the last question then. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor who fell into the hands of robbers? Do you notice the significant change from the first question?
Yes.
Yeah.
The question which sparked the story is, who is my neighbor? The question we're left with in the end is, who was a neighbor to the man? This is quite a significant transformation, and I think particularly apt for us today. The lawyer asks a question and says, who is my neighbor? I want to keep the law, so tell me who my neighbor is. So this guy is, and this woman is, and so on and so forth. There's a flip side to the question, who is my neighbor? And the flip side of the question is, who isn't my neighbor? So the question, he wants to keep the law. So he asks Jesus to narrow down and says, tell me who my neighbor is, and by implication, who my neighbor isn't. So I'm absolved from loving these people so long as I love these people. So I keep the law by limiting my love and my compassion and my care. And that's the way a legalistic approach to rules and regulations works. It's actually about the limiting of compassion. The question Jesus asks is completely different. Because the question Jesus asks is, who do you think was a neighbor to the man? Now, question from that question is, who has responsibility for the definition of a neighbor? Who has responsibility for the definition of neighborliness?
We do.
It's just as well, because I think we need to make this a little bit more complicated. If this is me, if I was in the position of this young man asking the original questions, Jesus turns it all on his head. He wants to know, who can I define as my neighbor? And by implication, who I can define as being outside my responsibility. Jesus flips it right round and says, the recipients of your attention get to decide whether you are a neighbor or not. The power to define neighborliness rests in the hands of the recipient of neighborliness. There's a difference, you see. One of the things we need to distinguish between and take account of in any of our relationships with those outside our in-group is intent and impact. It is not under this definition of neighborliness, all I require in this is to have the intent to love somebody. Now, if the recipient of my compassion says, I didn't feel that as neighborliness, that, well, I'm sorry, I intended. That's all I intended. So, you know, the loving thing to do is to tell you from the Bible that you're going to hell, or that you're not included in this group. You're not one of us. That is the loving thing to do, because then it allows you the chance to correct yourself and come inside the circle. Jesus flips that on the head and says, you must pay attention to the impact of your actions. It's not just about intent, because the recipient, the impact of your actions on another person, they get to decide whether it was a neighborly action or not. This story alerts us to the importance of impact when it comes to neighborliness and compassion. So, and I'm going to bring it right home to you here. It may be possible to define the loving thing to do in America is to close your borders. That way we can better look after those of us who are inside. We can better look after the poor who are among us. But the Good Samaritan story says you also need to pay attention to the impact. What do the people gathering at your southern border say about your neighborliness? Because they're the ones who get to define whether your actions are neighborly or not. The power for that definition lies with those at the margins, just as the story Jesus told. Push law to its margins, it falls apart, and then you are required to act compassionately. Because in the story of the Good Samaritan, the priest and the Levite did the right thing. The problem was when keeping the law releases us from the need to have compassion, that's a bad law and needs to be changed. And if the intent of a law, when it is applied, results in a lack of compassion, then we need to give thought to the impact. It's probably a bad law and needs to be changed. Because the Samaritan story pushes
the power to define neighborliness to those who are at the edges. That's why I think in our era, this is such a sharp, sharp story. This is not just about being nice people and showing compassion. This goes right to the heart of how we enact the laws of our country towards those who are at the margins of our societies, at the borders of our nations. If the application of law results in a lack of compassion and a reduction in the volume of love in the world, it's that law needs to be examined. Because the power to define neighborliness comes down to the impact of our actions. Jesus has flipped the question completely around. Push back on that. We've maybe a couple of minutes. Well, not even that. We've a minute. any pushback on that? As a, we didn't do this in Sunday school.
Over there, Glenn.
It's a corner. Yes.
I've been researching for our congregation signs. Put a new sign on our grounds to have pithy sayings and invite people and such. And language is so powerful, and so many congregations in our town say something along the lines of, join us. That's immediately a closed circle. The words us and you, close gates. And I've got to get my thesaurus out and really, really look at the words.
Thank you. So maybe if you can find 5 minutes in between all the other sessions and so on that are happening, and maybe rewrite this story from the perspective of the man. Who did he experience neighborly action from? The ones who kept the law or the ones who broke the law? And what opportunities are out there for us to defy the stereotypes people have of us? What opportunities are there out there for us to go beyond mere legalism, important and all as it is to keep the rules? Where are the opportunities being presented to us to go beyond even what the law is required, maybe even to break the law in order to increase the store of compassion in the world? And who are those to whom we need to cede some power to tell us, apologies, to tell us whether our actions towards them are being our neighborly or not? You've earned a coffee.